Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Golden, and welcome to Making Markets. This show explores the psychology and structure that make up markets all over the world. Each week, we speak to experts about a different market so you can see what actually happens when money changes hands. From mainstream stock and bond markets to esoteric niches like vineyards, antique art, and crypto, we explain the transactions that underpin our economy. Making Markets is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can find all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources at joincolossus.com.
Eric Golden is the CEO of Canopy Capital. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of Canopy Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes and should not be construed or relied on as investment, legal, or tax advice. Clients of Canopy Capital may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast, including positions that are contrary to the opinions offered.
My guest today is Aaron Edelheit, the CEO and portfolio manager at Mindset Capital. Aaron has spent his career practicing value investing in overlooked industries like housing after the 2008 recession or cannabis today. But today, we start the conversation by talking about another overlooked topic, burnout and the importance of disengaging from work. We then talk about the cannabis industry, the myths and opportunities, and why Aaron raised a venture fund to invest in cannabis beverages. This is a timely conversation recorded just ahead of the news that the DEA will reschedule cannabis, providing a massive boost to the industry, particularly around taxation. Please enjoy this conversation with Aaron Edelheit. Aaron, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about work ethic and finance, which is such a funny, sensitive topic. And to give people some background, it's a topic that's talked a lot about inside finance with other people that work in the business, but nothing you ever usually share more broadly. A lot of people get burnt out. I've seen breakdowns. I've seen all sorts of things happen. And for me, starting in Fidelity, I think one of the first stories you hear is Peter Lynch, and I think maybe his father was a doctor or his respect for the medical profession was, when you're young and you're growing as an analyst, you got to do rounds like a resident would. And the reason is you stay up till 2 a.m. and have bleary eyes and just keep following is the more things you see, the better of an investor you can be. There's no other way to get there besides just tremendous work hours. We had Jim Bianco on, and I was asking about this because he was talking about COVID and return to work. And when I first started, you had to be at your desk at 7:30 and you didn't leave till 6:30 was early. And if you had to stay, you stayed. Obviously, that's changed over time with COVID. But I thought a really interesting place based on your background and study of this would just be burnout in finance or maybe burnout in general.
Thank you so much, because I think this is one of the most under-discussed topics. So I manage people's money. And in general, if you were working at Fidelity as an analyst, your job was to consume information. And then if you were a portfolio manager, in the end, it was all about decision-making. How do you make the best decision? And what I've found is that after 25 plus years of professionally investing, managing money, the old way of thinking that you've got to grind out, in my experience, is wrong. It's not only my experience, but the science is all there, is to make the best decisions and to have your brain process the information the right way. You've got to give yourself breaks. And that what I have found is that a lot of the hard work or the grinding is for show. This is an identity. I am a hard worker, and it's not about the end result. It's not about the best decision making, but it's more of an identity and a culture that is about this uniform of hard work. And I say this because I'm a workaholic. I am driven in ways that I don't fully appreciate. And so what I have had to do personally is I fell back on my own tradition, which is Judaism. And in a very dark time, thankfully, when I was much younger, I fell back in, oh my goodness, no matter how hard I'm working, it's not improving my end results. And I feel miserable and I'm going down a very dark path. I had a Crackberry at the time, Blackberry. And so I said, what happens if I, on Friday night, when I go to sleep, I'll turn it off and I'll try to make it till noon the next day. And it seemed like a Herculean task. Like, how could I not work? Saturday, the market's closed. Literally nothing is happening, right? Maybe college football is happening in the fall. And it's like, and I make it to noon. And it just seems so difficult. And what I eventually did is I realized, oh, I could do it. And then after a couple of weeks, kind of make it to 2 or 3. And eventually I started this practice of, hey, could I turn off my phone and my computer and give myself a day? For me, it transformed my life in many, many ways. And I've now been doing this for a very long time. And I saw these wonderful benefits. I then built this business, buying foreclosed homes, fixing them up, renting them out. It went nuts. Grew from 4 homes to like 2,500 single family rentals. I had at the peak like 180 employees. It was a totally crazy experience. Throughout that entire time, I was observing a Sabbath. And I can honestly tell you is that would have failed. We had so many close calls, so many crazy things that happened in the chaos of that. I probably would be divorced, some version of this, if I didn't take a break. And then what I realized is when I watched all the behavior across the company, I realized I was showing by example that people didn't really believe me, even in my own company. And so what I decided to do is I spent 3.5 years working on a book, researching all the scientific research, and my editor ended up saying, this isn't a scientific work. You've got to remove all these footnotes or whatever. It's just too much because the science is overwhelming that we need breaks. We need time off. And I can go into some of what I learned in the book, but I now look back. I don't know how everybody stays on all the time with every contact you've ever met in business. Being able to ping you doesn't mean you have to respond, but they're immediately in your brain and that you can be distracted at any moment, at all time. It seems insane. I could never go back.
I want to probe on it a little bit because it's a topic that I've talked with many different people on, not necessarily from a scientific study, just from a how people feel about it. And I was an analyst and I became a PM. Your life definitely changed. And then in those early days when you're a young person and you're at the office, I think you're spot on that there's a tremendous amount of theater. And why, to me, finance is an easy industry is, although there might be objective numbers that you can look at certain levels, if you're an analyst and you're just trying to find information and be a source and kind of assist the investment process, that theater is kind of the sorting process, this competitive, who do we want to hire? Who do we want to promote? Who gets to the next level of the game? And so you got to a very successful point. You had a very successful exit. When you were younger, do you think you would tell your younger self to take days off? They're competing against all these other kids.
That's when I actually started. So I've been interested in investments for a very long time. I don't know why. I remember my dad having the newspaper open with the stock tables, and I asked him what that was at a very young age, and he explained that I was fascinated. And so in college, I was that kid who would talk nonstop about stocks. Actually turned out to be a huge benefit because one of my college friends started a business with his father and then sold it. 2 years out of college, I'm researching stocks for a personal finance magazine that doesn't exist anymore called Individual Investor, and researching and running a newsletter, portfolio of stocks, and writing research reports. And he calls me up and he was like, hey, we're selling our business. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. So what are you, like a millionaire now? And he was like, well, yeah. So we talked and he was like, why don't you manage some of my money? And so I then moved above my parents' garage. So there's literally the middle of New Hampshire. There's nothing to do. And for 4 years, from 1998 to 2002, I was a golden god. I would work 7 days a week. I averaged like 28% net returns in the dot-com bubble and crash. I was invested in small cap value, spinoff, turnarounds, none of the tech. And everything seemingly was amazing. And in 2002, I had this incredible year where I was up 30%. The market was down 30 or 40. I forget exactly the numbers. Everything seemed to be taking off and I made more money. And I was like, oh my God, but I wasn't happy and I wasn't fulfilled. Something was wrong. And then I had these series of events that is just life. taken on a partner and started fighting. And then we broke up and there was all kinds of acrimony. And then I got sick and doctors didn't know what was wrong with me. And it turned out to be misdiagnosed appendicitis. And then during all of that, suddenly I'm not outperforming, but I'm underperforming. Too young and stupid to realize that if you're doing something different, there's going to be times when you underperform. My first thought was, well, I'm underperforming. So I got to grind even harder. I'm clearly not giving enough. And what I found is there was no change. And out of literally desperation, I would remind myself that I'm not Aaron, the portfolio manager. I'm just Aaron. It's okay to just be Aaron. It's okay to just be some guy. And that the world keeps going without you. And that's both a relief and it's humbling. And then what I found is that I could breathe and that I suddenly, instead of this constant, like, oh my God, I got to do all this stuff, I found that I would have this rest, renewal, and excitement to turn back on. When 2008 came around and I was down 40%, the end of the world looked near. Instead of freaking out and panicking, I started a partnership to start buying foreclosed homes. That changed my life. Allows me to live where I live right now. And part of why I spent writing the book and part of why I like passionately talking about this is the data is all there. The way we're working is completely unhealthy and unproductive. And that there are just tremendous amounts of studies. And one of my favorite ones is literally the job that you have as an investor is to make good decisions. Or if you're in any other industry, is to like innovate. And when you are not actively engaged in your brain, there is a part of your brain called the default mode network. And you ever have the proverbial idea in the shower? You're going for a walk and suddenly something occurs to you. That's because when you're not actively engaging your brain and you're kind of like daydreaming or you're letting your mind wander, there's a part of your brain that goes into overdrive that starts taking all the information it's taken in and tries to form patterns. So imagine if you're actively engaged, if you're constantly sending emails, if you're always on your phone, you're not giving your brain the space to actually form the ideas that will help you succeed in the modern world.
I guess the pushback or the skepticism would be the correlation and causation of all of it. That specifically, I think that I get to mentor or talk to a lot of young people who want to become investors. And I was the same thing. I think it was a famous investor at Bear Stearns. I think it was Ace Greenberg said they hire PhDs who are hungry and dumb. And what that meant was they wanted young people that were so driven, they would work whatever it took to figure out to help to be part of a system. And maybe that's just a big complex that Wall Street pushes on young people to find out like who's the kind of the craziest of them. But it's that crop that like me becomes a PM someday. And I think back on it and I know that my life was massively out of balance and maybe in some ways still is. But I also look back at it with a bit of fondness that I wouldn't have learned anything. If a PM starts underperforming and starts taking vacation or days off, that PM is going to be fired. What you expect is that PM better be the last person to shut the lights off on the desk to keep working extra hard to catch up. Even though science might agree with it, it's also this really interesting pressure that's the complete opposite of what you're proposing.
So glad you mentioned this. I am actually advocating that you can work harder and get better results. And the data proves this through productivity that you can actually accomplish more in 6 days than you can in seven. Maybe for a week or two, you can go on benders and do 7 days. But I have research on my side. What I am not advocating for is a 4-hour workday. I am talking about full out work, but that regularly scheduled breaks. And what I'm saying is be work all the time, work nonstop, be at your desk, show that you're there is not what companies, investors, and PM would want. What they want is the end result. And I'm not talking about performance. What is the quality of your decision making? What is the quality of your research? And your analysis of that research. That's where the regular breaks become very, very important. If you are tired, you're going to make mistakes in your analysis, and you are not going to have mental clarity. And so what I would say is that for a lot of these companies, it's the same concept of what used to happen in sports. Rub some dirt in it. Get up. Who cares about this? If you see what happens in modern sports right now, how do they treat athletes? The minor, oh my gosh, he tweaked his oblique. Did they care in like the 1980s? No. But now they realize they need these people to be on peak condition. And if you follow the best athletes, what they will do is they will regularly schedule breaks, take naps. During the season, athletes are sleeping like 9 hours a day. Our brains use 20% of the energy of our body. How can we possibly believe that athletes need breaks and a lot of sleep and our brains don't? And if you follow the guy, Matthew Walker, about sleep, the importance of sleep is just incredible. And then we're not even talking about the lifelong challenges, where there are a tremendous amount of entrepreneurs or investors who then look back with great regret over their life. Oh man, I really caused serious health damage to myself. I'm dealing with mental health problems now. I'm now divorced. I just think that I don't think it's an either or. I think it's, hey, how do I operate in peak condition? That's the question that should be asked. I am very convinced, and the data is overwhelming, that working nonstop and grinding is not the solution.
So let's move to your investment process now. Let's talk about you, the investor. So small caps, spin outs, it sounds like Seth Klarman's Margin of Safety book. And I got the sense from doing our research on you, you're a pretty hardcore value investor. So walk me through your investment process, what you're currently working on.
What I found now, just looking back, is I don't really like the trading aspect of this. I'm a very passionate, sometimes emotional guy. And I studied enough of the great traders. The last thing you want to be as a trader is emotional and passionate. You need to be cool as a cucumber. What I love is finding investments or uncovering a trend or investing in stuff before people realize what's going on. There's change going on. There's something being masked. That's why I was like either spinoffs or restructurings, or turnarounds. And I love that detective process, that uncovering the needle in the haystack or the diamond that no one sees. I love finding out about sectors that I have no idea or businesses and learning how they actually operate. And so my investment process is I started in like microcaps and deep value and those kind of things. And I don't mind illiquidity. So when I suddenly started looking at houses as what I thought was a side project, I was like, oh, this is like a microcap. What other people thought is they looked at me like I had a third eyeball, like, why would you buy homes? Don't you know they're all worthless? And to me, I was like, well, I can do the research and I can see that in Atlanta and Charlotte, Orlando and Tampa, this many people on a net basis, the population increases, 30 years of demographic data. This is how much it costs to build a home. You do the math, you're going to run out of homes. It's just not a very complicated thing. I've loved that process. Then it allows me to be open to things that other people would be like, oh, I can't invest in that. I'm like, ooh, tell me more. You think about how many really, really smart people there are in finance. I don't want to compete against any of them. I want to try to be either ahead of them or just watching them being like, good luck, guys. To me, it's like being an investor in AI right now. I wouldn't put myself against any of those people, any hot sector. And so where that leads me now is I already told you I'm a workaholic, and that will manifest itself in sometimes I'll have really bad bouts of insomnia. And so a low dose cannabis has been life altering to me. And so that led me to look at the cannabis industry, and it's federally illegal. So that already wipes out what I used to think was 95% of the institutional investors. Now I actually think it's more than 99%. And so already I'm interested. And so I've just gone down this path right now of doing deep dive research. It's led me to launch a dedicated cannabis fund. It led me to launch now a hemp beverage venture fund. I never thought I'd be a VC or a value investor would be a VC, but we can talk about that. And it's because I see this just massive wave of cannabis adoption and almost no institutional participation or almost no research going on. So if I just do the basic blocking and tackling of due diligence and research, and I'm already seeing it in my numbers, I'm going to put up wonderful returns for investors.
Walk us through the cannabis industry, because as it came along, it's federally legal. It wasn't legal in the States. There was a lot of hype behind that. It wasn't the AI or maybe to the same level. But when they were going to legalize cannabis, I remember all of these pitch plans and funds, and it's just going to be this amazing unlock of economic prosperity. And I was on the muni side, so I was looking at states planning this. And my question was, if Colorado does it, and then the state next to it does it, if everyone does it, there's going to be a supply issue that we haven't experienced before. I don't think cannabis, it went through a hype cycle, but were you investing it in those early days before the states regulated it or some states regulated it?
I started researching and investing in the end of 2018, beginning of 2019. And so there's kind of two waves of cannabis hype. The first one was when Canada federally legalized. And it's very important. This is one of my favorite things is you have companies like Tilray or Canopy Growth that literally went up like 200x. And because it's federally legal in Canada, those Canadian cannabis companies could list on U.S. exchanges. So the pitch they were making is, wake, wake, nod, nod, when the U.S. comes, invest in us, we got you, right? Canada by itself is smaller than California in terms of the cannabis market. They had no idea what they were doing. There's some crazy stories of like they didn't even know how many people they needed or to harvest it in 90 days. It's just really incredible stuff. And in fact, most of them had shut down their facilities. They couldn't operate it. But then there was another hype cycle that came to the U.S. this time. And so states have legalized cannabis, either medical or adult use. But then because it's federally illegal, there's no access to the banking system. These stocks are not traded on U.S. exchanges, and they're traded on secondary, tertiary, Canadian exchanges or over-the-counter. So to someone like me, if you're over-the-counter, like, that's normal business to me. And then you have this hype cycle into Biden. It's going to, oh my gosh, the Democrats are going to control. They're going to legalize it. And then not only did they not legalize it, then you had inflation and interest rates soar. And this is what came to my terrible 2022, is anything speculative. God forbid something federally illegal. The tide went out and everyone was naked. I actually, at the end of 21, beginning of 22, I launched a dedicated cannabis fund thinking, oh, cannabis stocks are down 50%. How much further could they go down? The answer is another 50%. But what I loved is I ran towards it. Because what I was seeing is just fundamental misunderstandings. One of them being that it's easy to grow cannabis. It's called weed, and you can grow it outside. If you think about 8 years ago, as a society, we've never grown cannabis at scale before or professionally. And then what you find is like the flower that you smoke has no protection. It's like trying to grow an apple without its skin. That's why most of it's grown indoors. And the temperature, you ever see the hazmat suits people wear, not to protect themselves, it's to protect the plant, because it's incredibly susceptible to mold, disease, and pests. And that's why you had failed harvests in Canada, left and right. And then one of my favorites is a company called Air Wellness and growing cannabis in Florida. They lost power for 4 hours and lost 3 months of production. It's a very, very sensitive plant. It's very hard. The other thing you need to know is every state, because there's no interstate commerce, every state, it's like its own country, wildly different regulatory rules. Cannabis can't cross state lines. And so you have this rush to, oh, we'll just build and then we'll sell because we're one of the few providers. You've just had this massive weirdness and experience. But then meantime, you have companies go up and fail. But in the meantime, you have cannabis adoption continuing to go up. And so one of the things that I love is when you see a trend, I think of cannabis as the great replacement. It is replacing consumption that's just more toxic. So to me, it's like you can only take Ambien for 2 weeks. You wake up groggy and kind of out of it. You can take a low dose gummy and you're fine. And then if you think about alcohol, 140,000 Americans die every year directly from alcohol, 4,000 children. And if you think about taking cannabis where it'll actually help you sleep and you'll wake up with no hangover. This is amazing. You think of opioids. Ex-NBA All-Star told me he had this gnarly knee surgery. The opioids were eating his stomach, not to mention you can get addicted to them and all the people that are dying and overdosing and replacing it with cannabis. It's like why the NBA finally removed the ban on cannabis. It's because every athlete's already taking it. The one that got me the most bullish of cannabis is that workers' comp claims go down wherever cannabis is legalized. And you're like, wait a minute, why would workers' comp claims go down? And then you just realize that people are already taking really toxic things to get through the day. And then cannabis can replace it, and they're just getting injured less because it's less toxic. And so I put all these things together. You have this long adoption. It's super messy. There's very little due diligence or research going on compared to other industries. You have myths and misunderstandings. And what that generally should lead to is a lot of alpha and a lot of opportunity. And that's been my experience after my initial gut punch.
When you look at the industry broadly, I've seen people compare crypto to cannabis of a lot of people are using it, regulatory uncertainty, constant fighting. What do you compare cannabis to of other industries? Is it gaming or what other industries do you think it most resembles?
What I compare it to is really alcohol. There is no medicinal benefit to alcohol, but there is very clearly medicinal benefits to cannabis. You may consume too much cannabis and you may want to die, but you will not die. If you consume too much alcohol, you could die. And so the way I think about is alcohol during prohibition or after prohibition, sports gambling, how it's just now accepted. It's kind of like those things, but it's still because there was so much misinformation and myths around it, and it feels like illegal or something bad. There's just a lot more misunderstandings about cannabis and the plant because there has been this campaign since the 30s of basically telling people it was one thing when everyone could see that wasn't true. And now we have the data and the science, and we also have President Nixon's senior advisor being like, we were trying to target African-Americans and hippies, and that's why we made it illegal. And then what's happened is a state will legalize. They'll look around and be like, well, everything's just a little bit better. And then the state next to them was like, hey, why don't we get that tax revenue and probably regulate this? And that's why it's continued to grow, is the society has not collapsed. Canada is Canada. And it's like everything's just a little bit better. And then all of a sudden, you'll find more conservative states, someone's aunt crossed state lines and taking a gummy to go to sleep, or their hip hurts. And they're like, oh man, my aunt is doing, but she's not a pothead. And it just changes everything.
When you just touched on the growing part, which is fascinating, how hard it is to grow, I had read that when this stuff was legalized, suddenly there was a supply problem. They had too much supply. So if it was so hard to manufacture, do we not get a supply?
So here's the thing. It's super easy to make mediocre, inconsistent weed. Anyone can do it. But if you want to make really good quality cannabis that people want to consume for the right price, it becomes very difficult. And it's the consistency and scale that becomes hard. And so what happens is, yes, if I built a facility in Massachusetts and it costs me, and this has happened, $1,500 to $2,000 a pound to grow cannabis, and suddenly competition increases and other states around it legalize, so I don't have the same demand from out-of-state people, everything's fine when the price is $3,000 to $4,000 a pound. What happens if it goes to 1200 and your cost is 1500 to 2000? Then you have a problem. And so this is where the basic research and due diligence is like, hey, what is your cost? What are you disclosing and what are you not? And then just realizing that a lot of companies have been set up to race and to basically have regulatory capture, but in the long run, that is a very dangerous path. And instead to look who's working on the cost structure and what advantages do they have? You know, I live in Southern California and it's like the average temperature is 72 degrees and sunny and it doesn't snow and it doesn't get hot and there aren't a lot of bugs. You're going to be able to augment that environment and have a cost advantage over everything because there's no inflation on the sun and perfect weather. And then understanding that the other thing that's really messed with people is other people thinking, oh man, I just got to build a large facility and then I'll get scale. But then the other thing you learn about cultivation is the power user in cannabis, the real connoisseur, they want variety. This is just a commodity. Then why does the color purple get a premium price? And you're like, wait a minute. Some of the assumptions around this industry are not right. Why would anyone care about the color purple? Why would anyone care exactly about the smell? It's the same thing as wine. If you're making like two-buck chuck, anyone can make two-buck chuck. But what about when you want that 20 or 25 or God forbid, you want the $40 wine? You're not buying New Jersey wine. You're having people over. Why don't you go get me a good California Napa wine or Sonoma, right? Understanding that the consumer wants a lot of turn and variety in new genetics, wants to try and experience things, and they're willing to pay up for it. And so in a weird way, the more scale you have, the harder it is to respond to the market because it's much more of a fast fashion industry. And so there are entrants now that are doing the craft side, really small facilities, turning the genetics really fast, focused on costs, but really focusing on the speed and response to the market and having much smaller batches. And so it's just interesting watching the industry evolve and different strategies evolve and different people understanding the opportunities in the market.
With that example of the large growers versus small batch, wine's an interesting example. It makes me think of like craft beer or the amount of advertising behind the brands. In this space, how does that make you think about the public markets versus private markets?
So I'm participating in both because there's opportunity in both. Vast majority have been in the public markets, but there's still a lot of really interesting private companies. And this is why I started what I'm calling the venture fund is because of what's happening in hemp. And specifically, it's the wildest thing. So I've been beating my head against the wall. I already told you the big bold thesis on THC, the adoption, I think we're 20-year wave we're going on, but it's federally illegal. But in 2018, they passed a farm bill, didn't really pay attention to it that much. And what you need to know is hemp is a genetic of the cannabis plant that just has very low levels of THC. If hemp is grown on a USDA certified farm and it's harvested with 0.3% THC by weight or less, it's federally legal and any cannabinoid derived from that hemp is not on the Controlled Substances Act. After that, you started having like gummies and some bunch of stuff showing up at gas stations and other places and synthetic alternatives. And I was like, oh, that's just not something I would pay attention to. Until in October, I read an article that said 10% of liquor store sales in Minnesota were THC drinks. And I was like, that can't be right. And you just go on Google, what's the size of the US alcohol market? And it's $262 billion a year in sales. And I'm like, well, that's not right. So then what do I do? Picked up the phone and I called liquor store chains. I called breweries. I called brands. I called distributors. And what happened is when Minnesota legalized, they looked at the hemp laws and they said, oh, well, since hemp is federally legal, low-dose hemp drinks can be sold anywhere. Bars, restaurants, liquor stores. I dove deep into the market, went down a rabbit hole I still haven't recovered from. And it is now, I actually think, one of the most underreported stories in all of business is the US alcohol market is being disrupted and it's spreading like wildfire because every other state has looked at what Minnesota is doing. And now retailers and distributors are moving with the speed. And here's the thing. We already know that people love THC. These are 2, 5, 10 milligram drinks. And what you're having is people that would never step foot in a dispensary who are looking for an alternative to alcohol, which we already know the younger generation isn't drinking, like our generation. And our generation is looking for healthier alternatives. That's why you have the non-alcoholic beer space taking off, but you still want an effect at the end of the day. And so what's happening is low-dose hemp beverages, federally legal. You can order with credit cards, can order it online. You can get banking, all of that, because it's all federally legal. And it's taking off like literally wildfire. And the entire ecosystem that was under stress, alcohol retailers, alcohol distributors, are, oh my God, my volumes are coming down. What do I do? And I can replace it with non-alcoholic beer, but the margins are much lower. My profits getting killed. All of a sudden, hemp beverages come. They have higher margins than alcohol. It's flying off the shelves. And so you just have the entire ecosystem. And then if I'm an alcohol company, I see the writing on the wall. I see that cannabis is replacing me and that the trends are negative. Do I care what's in a can or a bottle? This is my way to participate. I personally think that this could be like 20% of the US alcohol market. And so this is like part of what I see. And it's changed my life. I'll have like a low dose beverage. I mean, just imagine I offered you a drink that relaxed you, gave you a buzz. Food is more pleasurable. Music is more enjoyable. You'll sleep great at night and you wake up with no hangover. You would be like, that doesn't exist. Or there's some catch I don't know about. And I'm here to tell you that it not only exists, it's federally legal and the consumers are tripping over themselves. And so they're selling like crazy. And because it's cannabis related, no one's investing in it. And because no one's in this space.
I've wondered why you would see it in like convenience stores, just like with water. It seems like this isn't real or it's fake or something. How does the cannabis industry think about low-dose THC drinks? Does it consider it a complement or a substitute to cannabis?
This is the problem. The cannabis industry has been dealing with trauma. They've gotten kicked in the teeth. They have no access. One of the most remarkable things is my research, and I've done a lot of deep dive. You talk to these companies and you analyze the data. These are not dispensary customers. These are alcohol customers. And the problem is the cannabis industry is in distress, not thinking clearly, running around like they're chickens with their heads cut off. And they look at this and they go, oh, like a little kindergartner, that's not fair. How dare they have it this easy? They're looking at the entire hemp industry, but they're not clearly looking at hemp beverages and being like, wait a minute, this is the most popular in red and purple states. And this is massive total addressable market expansion. And this is the battering ram that destroys the stigma of THC that actually legalizes cannabis. I need to participate or invest or be part of this. And to me, it's a broader issue. And the larger cannabis companies are what are called multi-state operators. And they're all in a variety of states. They're, most of them are in distress, because they went through this land rush, took on expensive sale leaseback of their facilities because there are no access to financing. But then I want to describe the situation to you. You have almost no access to capital. You're a farmer. You run retail stores. You do wholesale distribution. You're trying to develop brands. You're running a professional kitchen for edibles. And you're doing this in effectively 7 to 15 different countries with wildly different regulatory rules.
That's a nightmare.
It's an impossible business. And the older I get, the more I realize those who focus win. If you're focused, you win. And I think that's part of the dynamic. I think it's this unfair. I think a lot of the cannabis industry also, if you ever walk into a dispensary and you talk to a lot of these people, they understand flower well. They may understand edibles well, but they do not understand beverages. And so they're just confused by the whole thing. And then if you walk into a dispensary and I ask, hey, can I have a 2 milligram, 5 milligram? I mean, all those people are in love with the flower. They love the plant. And the idea that you would drink your weed is almost an insult to them. They just don't see it the same way. And that's why you see they're threatened and confused by it and are in some states actively fighting it to get it removed instead of seeing like, oh my God, this is a great opportunity. Look at all the benefits to this. And that's why you see more allies in the alcohol world where they're like, hey, this is great.
Yeah. So I was a big investor in tobacco, and I remember big tobacco attacking vape and nicotine with fury. And I was like, I don't get it. And then I realized like, and it's different because cannabis isn't where tobacco is. It's a powerful lobbyist. They had been so destroyed and wrapped in this world that when the disruptor comes, it's very similar. Same thing with banking and crypto. When the thing shows up, you've worked so hard to build a regulatory moat that you've navigated. So the lawyers at big tobacco are worth more than anyone else there. And then someone finds a little light and goes around it. But you've worked really hard to build this fortress. And so they end up going and attacking at first and trying to destroy all of these upstarts and ban them and just full onslaught of destruction against the new thing. And that's why I was like, I wonder if cannabis is acting the same way that big tobacco did. And it sounds very similar.
Oh, that's a great insight. I'm going to steal that from you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Go for it.
It's also really interesting. This relatively new industry, and you just don't have the level, if anything, the operational excellence is in short supply. You haven't had a diversity of opinion or just real due diligence or investors holding companies' feet to the fire, asking tough questions. You haven't really had that yet.
So I understand how a value investor ends up in cannabis. That part makes sense to me because you're trying to look where other people aren't and turn over rocks that someone hasn't in the research. That all makes sense. But a value guy starting a venture fund, that's more questionable to me. How has that transition been to writing checks on team and vision versus COGS and balance sheets?
Well, first of it comes with the knowledge that beverage companies are some of the best investments of all time. So let's just start there. That beverage company, especially when you can plug into the existing infrastructure, you really don't own a lot of assets or anything. All you really are is like recipe, brand, sales, and marketing. And then there's working capital if you grow. So I think Founders Podcast, one of the more recent ones, was the Red Bull founder. I don't know if you listened to it. The year before he died, his 50% stake was paying him $900 million a year in annual dividends. The best performing stock in the last 30 years, Monster Energy, with like 41,000 or some crazy percent. Past 5 years, Celsius up 5,000%. You think of like Seagram, Coca-Cola, remember Snapple back in the day. These are wonderful businesses and great characteristics of cash flow generation when you get to a certain scale. So I think that's the first thing, is that we know what happens when an industry takes off. And the way I think about it is I look at the comparative valuations and I'm saying any other startup that was showing triple digit growth and was struggling to raise $2 million or $700,000 in some cases, I'm getting valuations that just don't exist anywhere else in the venture world. And so that's how a value investor comes in, is because I want to participate in this. I think this is going to be a $50 billion a year market. I can do the due diligence and see the traction. I am not investing in companies that don't have a product. I want to see demonstrated operational performance, sales. I want to see your plan, and I want to invest with a value mindset. I don't want them to generate profits, because if you understand, in many ways, it's almost like a software company. It's that you have your code, you have your recipe, and then it's just all sales and marketing and distribution and getting it out there and getting people to drink and consume. And so you could be very capital efficient in this. And I'm generally paying on multiples of sales that just frankly feel absurd to me.
How hard is it to make a THC drink? Is it as hard as growing the plant?
No, it's much easier, but then it comes down to the details. There's so many ways in startups or young companies to blow up, but there's also these issues around THC is just a little different because it can be in the chemistry of it. I'm not going to try to mess up, but it can attach to the can liner. And then there's stability issues where what you want is management teams that understand this and understand, hey, how do we get the shelf life to be right? And that the last thing you want when you open a can of Coca-Cola is for that to have a different experience to you every time, or to be like, hey, this is a 10 milligram drink, but it's actually 7 or it's 13. That's a big problem. And then just who's going to handle the distributor and the distributor contract? And then some of these distributors will be like, yeah, I'll cover you. But then there's an early termination. But then when you add up all the distribution contacts, it's like, oh my God, your company's worth less than zero because for you to buy yourself out from all of these is the entire value of your company. And there's just like a bunch of, it seems deceptively simple, but it's actually not. So the beverage industry is kind of very, very different.
Yeah, I was assuming it was a very hard business. I was more worrying on the production of, in my head, look at it like craft beer. You go into a liquor store and there's aisles and aisles of craft beer, and some of them have broken out and sold to InBev back in the day, but now there seems to be a new one every week. And back to your idea that the consumer wants choice and change, and they want to try this one and they want to try that one. There's one of my favorite beers is called Boom Sauce. And I met the founder early on, he's local. And he was telling me, this is before craft beers went really nuts. It was like when Alchemist was a big deal and you'd have to like drive to these places to get these cans. He's like, look, someday you're going to go into a store and there's going to be two aisles of colored cans. There's going to be hundreds of them. And you're not going to know what to pick from, but you're going to know you're going to grab Boom Sauce and one other thing. And I thought it was a good idea. He proved to be brilliant. It was a wonderful business. But his theory was like, look, even the King of Saudi Arabia can't buy a 4-pack of beer for more than $25. And so what I was wondering with THC drinks is, yeah, you want to have the next liquid death and be the single drink that everybody wants at. Like, I just saw a stat that High Noon is the number one beverage in all of America, which is kind of wild to me that Spike Seltzer is number one. And so there could be a breakout brand, but what's the differentiating factor amongst these THC brands over time?
I mean, it's a great question. It's knowing who your customer is. The way I think about it is like anything else. It's being focused, knowing who your customer is, and delivering a consistent experience and value to the customer. And so the kind of companies I'm investing in are wildly different in terms of how they're approaching or what the customer is and who they're targeting. And they're focused on getting to scale and getting to scale so that they can lower costs, so they can continue to have a flywheel effect. The difference between craft beer and cannabis is when craft beer boomed, we were at the end of increasing alcohol consumption and beer consumption is crashing. And so they're no longer in a growth market and they're now feeding on each other. The difference between THC and craft beer is we're at the very beginning stages of cannabis consumption. And in terms of people drinking and experiencing THC. So I actually think have years and years of abundance ahead of us. The problem is alcohol's expense.
It's compelling. Is it just the brands or are you looking at bank shots of like the special can manufacturers or are there other things that are of interest?
I'm looking. It's hard. It's harder in the infrastructure space. I'm looking. I haven't found anything as compelling yet. But right now, it's all brands that I'm looking at.
Well, when you find it, you're going to let me know. I do like the idea a lot, and I can see the play. Aaron, this has been a lot of fun. We end the episode with trying to figure out where we are in the desperation optimism curve. Where are we for cannabis? And maybe, I think I know where we are for THC drinks, but where would you say we are for the cannabis industry?
I think we passed rock bottom, and we're kind of through depression. And we're looking out. We kind of see hope. But the rug has been pulled from a federal reform perspective so many times, and there's been so much money lost that people are like, I don't believe. Even myself, I had a great year last year. I'm having a great year this year. I was telling my wife the other day, I'm just like looking behind myself being like, I know this isn't right. Something bad is about to happen. So when you're still worried about that, I think it's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Well, Aaron, thank you very much for the time. This has been fun.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you will find every episode of this podcast, along with transcripts, our weekly newsletter, and resources to continue your learning.